Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The theme of our guest's book and this hour is, in his opinion, how captured by Wall Street our political system is, why the banks have not been held accountable, and how the failure to enact effective regulation has put the country in danger of an even bigger crisis in the future. Our guest this hour is Neil Barofsky. His book is Bailout, an inside account of how Washington abandoned Main Street while rescuing Wall Street. Neil is the former Inspector General in charge of oversight for TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. He was nominated to that position by the President and confirmed by the Senate in late 2008, sworn into office on December 15th of 2008. He is now a fellow at the NYU School of Law. He also served as a federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York for more than 8 years. His job as Special Inspector General for TARP was to work to ensure against fraud and abuse in the spending of the $700 billion allocated for the bailouts. Our phone number, I would imagine we'll have more than a few calls during the course of this hour, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email was talk at WPR.org. And if you'd like, you can leave messages on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Neil.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks very much for being with us, sir.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
How did you get this job? The first part of the book outlines that, and it's kind of interesting how they selected you and how they really weren't prepared for your job and your offices and no chairs and no garbage cans. But first of all, how did they get you?
Well, no one was more surprised than me. I was a federal prosecutor in Manhattan doing, and I've spent years doing international narcotics cases, and then sort of the latter part of my career, I was a securities fraud prosecutor. I did a big securities fraud case against one of the big Wall Street institutions, REFCO, which was a commodities giant and a multi-billion dollar accounting fraud. And then earlier in 2008, I was asked to start up, and I founded a mortgage fraud group. We had a group, small group of prosecutors who were responding to the real spike in mortgage fraud that accompanied the lead up into the financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And after the bill was passed by Congress that gave Treasury the ability to raise up to $700 billion to bail out Wall Street, included in that bill was a provision that didn't get a lot of attention at the time, and which I wasn't even aware of, that created this new oversight body, this new inspector general that was supposed to provide oversight over Treasury's administration of this giant bailout fund. And part of that job was to provide oversight and to provide reports to Congress, but the other part was to create a whole brand new law enforcement agency from scratch that was going to police the TARP fund. And the call went out from the White House to the various U.S. attorney's offices around the country looking for potential applicants. And in October of 2008, my boss, the U.S. attorney at the time, Michael Garcia, called me in and asked me if I was interested in the job. At the time, I'd never heard of the job and wasn't terribly interested, but I think it was because of my background doing securities fraud and mortgage fraud,
right,
that was interested. You know, even though, as I told Mike, as I was trying to get out of it, because the last thing I wanted to do was give up my job in New York and move to Washington, I sort of stressed the fact that I was an Obama-contributing Democrat, and this was going to be a presidential appointment from George Bush at the waning days of his presidency. But he told me, and he later proved correct, that it really wasn't a political appointment. It was just they just wanted to find somebody who had that experience of investigating fraud.
Had you followed how TARP was presented to Congress and the debate over TARP before you took the job, Neil, while you were doing your other job?
I did. I did so, but in sort of a more of a detached way than I later would. Obviously, you know, living in New York City, blocks away from Wall Street. At the time, I was living in an apartment down in Chinatown, which is pretty close. You know, you couldn't help but notice what was going on with the financial crisis. And it was just a staggering, breathtaking series of events of these institutions that just seemed impregnable because their size and their history fall one by one. And I even remember in October talking to a colleague saying, you know, do you think AIG, asking me, do you think AIG could go under? And just being like, no, how could that possibly happen? How could a company that is respected and been around for so long? So was sort of paying attention to it, and I began to see a lot of the patterns that I learned from doing securities fraud cases, particularly investigation of Refco, of problems in the financial markets, problems with some of the different players, such as credit rating agencies, and seeing those issues sort of evolve, as well as what I saw from a mortgage, from doing mortgage fraud cases, and the real breakdown in mortgage underwriting and fraud controls, and was able to sort of see all that gather together and come to a point in 2008.
Did you think at that time, and do you think now, that we were at the brink of a financial collapse?
It did seem that way, although at the time, of course, I didn't have the information I would later learn once I got to Washington. And once I got there and got to speak with the people who were on the front lines of this and really get a sense of their fear and real terror about the closeness with which we were facing a financial apocalypse, I did come to believe that they were correct, that we really were that close to a complete collapse of our financial system. And when I got there in December of 2008, which was, you know, a couple months after TARP had been passed, and it seemed from the outside perspective like the worst of the crisis may have been behind us, but when I got there and I saw that there was still in a pretty high level of panic and concern that it could still take a wrong turn for the economy, and really that fear continued, I would say, all the way through 2009. Hmm. There was a real sense in Washington that there was a real danger that we could slip back and the financial crisis could come back with and be even worse than what we had.
Mm-hmm. When you got there and went through the process of getting garbage cans and a little bit of furniture into your office that was kind of dingy, there's one point in the book where somebody says, you know, you need to get up and running with this because you're supposed to be overlooking possible fraud, and half the TARP money might be out the door already and nobody's looked at how it was spent. Was that true? Was half the money out the door already?
You know, a good chunk of it had been either obligated or spent at that point. And I would say in those first couple of weeks that I was there, you know, huge amounts of TARP funds were continuing to be committed. So on my first day, right after Hank Paulson, then the Secretary of Treasury, swore me into office, within 2 minutes he told me that they were actually going to go ahead and bail out GM and Chrysler and their auto financing arms. And shortly after that was a huge additional bailout of Bank of America. So a lot of money had gone out the door, and a lot of money was going out the door really from the moment I got there. And it was true, there was very little oversight within the Treasury Department of this money going out. There really was no anti-fraud voice advocating on behalf of the taxpayer in looking out for potential opportunities for financial institutions and others to game the program, to commit outright fraud, but also just for the necessary types of conditions and incentives so that Treasury's policy goals could be fulfilled. So what happened as a result is the money went with virtually no strings attached and no incentives or conditions for the banks. Because you remember, you know, TARP was supposed to do more than just save the banks. Its original goal when Treasury asked for the money and when Congress gave them the money was that it was going to help the broader economy. It was going to help the money was supposed to go back into the economy through the banks, you know, to increase lending and to get credit going again so small businesses could borrow. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to help struggling homeowners. And when the money went out, unfortunately, with that voice not being present, none of that was accomplished. And, you know, we're still feeling the results of that almost 4 years later.
It was supposed to forestall foreclosures, right? Did it do that?
It really ended up being one of TARP's greatest failures. You know, initially, if you remember, what Treasury originally pitched and described was not what TARP actually did. What we were supposed to do is go out and buy $700 billion, essentially, of mortgages. It was going to be mortgages and the bonds, mortgage-backed securities, which were essentially bonds made up of a bunch of mortgages. And it was the drop in the value of these assets, which caused so much losses for the banks, which required a bailout. And we were originally told the idea behind TARP was to take those assets, take those mortgages off of the bank's balance sheets and put it on the United States government's balance sheets. And when they were asking for TARP funds, a bunch of mostly progressives in the House of Representatives, you know, who had no interest in voting for a giant bailout of Wall Street, you know, insisted, and it was actually written into the TARP bill. People don't remember this. It was actually written into the bill that Treasury was going to have to then modify these mortgages because of the raging foreclosure crisis, which was already underway in 2008. And frankly, that's what would mattered most to a lot of the members of the House in progressive districts who wanted to see not just Wall Street bailed out, but also Main Street. But when what happened was Treasury determined that they didn't have the time or the ability to go with Plan A of buying the mortgages, and instead they went and actually just plowed money into the banks, buying their common stock. And when they did that, they didn't put any conditions related to modifying mortgages or helping homeowners. And you know, that was the first of several lost opportunities to fulfill that promise to help homeowners as well as banks.
So what did the banks do with all that money, Neil?
Well, just getting the answer to that question turned out to be one of the biggest battles that I fought, as I describe in the book. When I got there, within 8 days, I made my first recommendation to Treasury, which was that they should require the banks to tell us, what are you doing with this money? You're getting all these hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars. How are you using it?
Right.
And you know, my reason for doing so wasn't just being nosy, although transparency, I think, is a fundamental part of any government program, but also as a way to measure whether Treasury's goals were being achieved. Were they really using the money and putting it back into the economy or doing other things with it? And I ran into such a brick wall, such resistance from within the Treasury Department, and it was really my first indication of how much the Treasury officials were towing the bank's line. And by that, I mean they were repeating arguments that had been made by the banks that it was impossible, that they kept telling me how money was fungible and that you really can't tell a TARP dollar apart from any other dollar. And, you know, we heard these arguments and we did a little research. I talked to some accountants. I talked to some economists. And we came up with a pretty good method, I think, of that Treasury could use to assess how the banks were using the funds. But we just ran into brick wall. I was told that my ideas were stupid, that I didn't understand, that I was playing politics. And this was sort of a running issue that lasted all the way through towards the end of 2009. But eventually we just decided to take matters into our own hands, and I did my own questionnaire, which I sent out to the banks. And what we found out was that the banks were doing a lot of things with the money, but lending and putting it back didn't seem to be one of them. They were buying other banks with TARP funds. They were taking the money, often with encouragement by the government itself, to buy up smaller, struggling banks. They hoarded the money. They used it, in their words, to build up fortress balance sheets so that if the economy continued to go downward or the crisis continued, they'd have insulation. They lent the money back to the government, and you know, by buying government debt and things like that. But unfortunately, lending and helping the economy grow was not one of the things that they did.
And you would think that there would have been, you were outraged, and there were some people who were outraged about all of that. You would think that Congress would have been outraged about that. Here you are in charge of overseeing this money. This is a huge amount of money. A lot of people are hurting. Their homes have been foreclosed on. And these people are taking the money and making themselves even more wealthy. Why wasn't there a huge amount of outrage about all of this early on, Neil?
You know, there was some degree of anger in Congress, and you know, there were certainly members of Congress who engaged with us and frankly were tremendously supportive of us in our efforts to bring this level of transparency. But for the most part, we didn't really see that type of sort of mainstream, you know, group outrage from Congress on these fundamental issues. And you know, I think a large part of it is that the financial institutions and the big banks, you know, have a tremendous amount of influence in Washington. Where I saw it the most was actually within the executive branch. I saw it most within the Treasury Department and in the regulators who are supposed to be policing Wall Street. But certainly they had a strong presence in Congress as well, and had a lot of influence on the regulatory reform that followed. And I suspect that was part of the you know, to the extent that the reaction was not as strong and as compelling as we would have hoped. But I would say this, that, you know, we really did have some strong friends in Congress, and we really would not have been able to accomplish anything were it not for their support.
Mm-hmm. You start your book, and people have to think carefully about how they will start their book, and it gives us a flavor of how things are done in Washington and how people like you might be intimidated if you want to go far in this field. Tell me about the meeting that you had with Herb Allison and why you choose to start your book with that story and that conversation with him.
Sure. So in April of 2010, I'd been there about 16 months or so, and Herb Allison had come in about a year earlier to take over TARP, and it was his job. He was the assistant secretary to run the TARP program, and he had an illustrious career on Wall Street. Before then, he had been the president of Merrill Lynch. He had then become CEO of TIAA CREF and had actually come back to government out of retirement to take over Fannie Mae when they hit the rocks and had to be bailed out by the government. And not surprisingly, Allison and I had clashed almost from day one. I was advocating, you know, a number of different tough protections, and you know, I was pushing back on a lot of Treasury's refusal to put in what I thought were really necessary protections for the taxpayer, and what I saw was this continued deference to the interest of these big banks. So we decided to have a clear-the-air conversation because it just became too often that it would devolve into shouting matches. At one point, Allison was told me how deeply he offended he was because I had used some clips from Secretary Geithner from a Saturday Night Live clip that in presentations that I gave, which sort of helping to explain the government's response in different things. So we had this clear-the-air conversation, and during it, he expressed to me that warned me that I was really doing myself harm, real harm to myself. And we talked about how my wife was pregnant. She was due in just a few weeks. It was going to be our first child. And he asked me what my future plans were, and wasn't I concerned that I might be doing myself harm by the harshness of my tone if I wanted to get a job in Wall Street or maybe somewhere in Washington? And I sort of explained to Allison that I really couldn't let those thoughts creep into my mind. I had a job to do and really couldn't worry about my long-term job prospects. You know, he pushed back pretty hard and told me that I was doing myself harm and that I really needed to change my tone, be less harsh in my observations about Wall Street and the administration. Otherwise, not only would I would really be harming my ability essentially to feed my family once this job was over, but with a good tone, I could really things could change for me, and I could get something, even a judgeship from the White House would be
Whoa.
On the table. So, you know, it was interesting. At the time, I was pretty angry, actually, at the conversation. And I walked out, and I called my deputy, who was a good dear friend of mine, who came down with me from New York, a fellow prosecutor named Kevin Pawlowski. And I called Kevin up, and I relayed him this story, and he compared it to Pablo Escobar, the notorious narcotics kingpin down in Colombia. Kevin and I are both longtime drug prosecutors before we moved into the white collar world. And Escobar had a method of corruption when he was really dominating the Colombian scene back in the 80s, 90s. And one of the things that he would do is he would go to a local official and he would offer them what was known as the gold or the lead or the bullet of the bribe. And essentially it was a promise to the official that if they were corrupt and worked for Escobar, great things, they'd give him giant piles of money and make them rich. But if they refused the offer, they'd put a bullet in their head, thus the gold or the lead. Hmm. And Kevin's observation was, I just received the Washington equivalent of the bullet or the bribe or the gold or the lead. So I started the book with it, you know, the answer to the rest of your question. I started the book with this story because I think what I began to realize over time was that Allison really wasn't threatening me or bribing me, even though that was my initial reaction. I realized that he was actually trying to be helpful in his own way. You know, as an elder statesman of Wall Street and now of Washington, he understood how everything worked, and he could see that even if I was, you know, sincere in my attempts in doing my job, that I really was doing myself harm. I mean, he was right, and really was trying to provide me, I think, with a helpful warning more than anything else. And with that realization, I thought this was sort of the perfect story to start a book, which is ultimately about the corrupting influences of the banks and the problems with incentives in Washington and how, you know, our government officials have become so captured to those interests, in no small part because they too are facing in some ways the bullet or the bribe. And this is a disincentive for regulators to do their jobs when they're squaring off from Wall Street because of the potential harm that they can do themselves and the tremendous reward that awaits them if they spin through the revolving door, as so many people do, and go to work within the industry and pay out. So I you know, there was some discussion with my editor and with the publisher of how to start this book. And, you know, when the idea first came to write this book, I felt like this needed to be in the beginning, and ultimately that's what we decided.
Neil Barofsky is our guest this hour. His book is Bailout, an inside account of how Washington abandoned Main Street while rescuing Wall Street, and it's definitely an inside account. Neil was former Special Inspector General in charge of oversight of TARP. He is now a senior fellow at New York University School of Law. Here's our phone number. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you would like to send an email, go to talk@WPR.org or send a message on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll move into a conversation about Timothy Geithner. Neil says, I think if Obama loses in November, Geithner has to shoulder a large portion of the blame. It was his policies that led to the too big to fail banks getting even bigger, more powerful, and more dangerous than they were before the crisis. So we'll talk about Timothy Geithner in a moment and much more. Join our conversation, please. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll move Timothy Geithner into this conversation in a moment. We have a ton of phone calls, and I'd like to get to some of you who have been on hold. Let's start with Maura in New Berlin. Hi, Maura.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am just wondering if the guest has any knowledge of why, throughout the crisis or since, there doesn't seem to have been any mention about the role of the public accountants in this massive fraud. I'm assuming they issued unqualified opinions on the financial statements of the fraudsters, and I wonder why they haven't been implicated and, in fact, maybe driven out of existence, just as Arthur Andersen was with the Enron scandal.
Well, you know, I think actually the tail end of your question, unfortunately, probably provides some of the response to the first part. You know, there, much like we have banks that are too big to fail, we have some big accounting firms that I think are viewed as too big to fail. And after Arthur Andersen was driven out of business, I think there is a fear that if another accounting big one of the big four accounting firms was taken down, that it would create, you know, unacceptable consolidation within the industry. And I think that does play a part. I remember I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office when the big investigation into KPMG for its participation in a massive tax shelter scheme was underway. And I think those types of concerns were very, very much out there. But I think, you know, I think the other part of it is that, you know, we haven't seen any big-scale prosecutions of the financial institutions themselves arising out of the crisis. So, you know, going that next level down to the accountants as well, it understandably hasn't happened also. It doesn't mean it's fair or it's right. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I saw as a prosecutor in particular was that, you know, the accounting companies, as long as they were getting their fees, were happy to look the other way, not dig too deep, not necessarily be complicit in the fraud, but not necessarily doing their jobs, which, of course, is to pay careful attention and to identify this misconduct. And I think that was a problem and a likely characteristics for the big banks during the financial crisis. But, you know, these days, I think we've got to first try to get the big guys at the banks charged before we can sort of get down to that next level, because without having a sense of liability for those who are potentially committing the fraudulent acts, you really can't go after those who enabled them.
So there are mixed reports as to whether or not the Department of Justice is leading in an active investigation that's addressing just that. Are they?
Well, you know, there was this big announcement about 6 months ago that they were going to form a new sub-task force of another larger task force that had been in effect for several years that was going to dig into some of the mortgage-backed securities and some of the toxic assets, some of this financial crisis-related conduct. And at the time, I was a bit skeptical. It seemed to me it was more about election year press releases and having the appearance of doing something rather than actual substantive investigations. And indeed, when the original task force was announced back in November 2009, one of its stated goals was to hold those accountable through criminal prosecutions who led to the financial crisis. And look, whether you go back to that 2009 date or look at the last 6 months, we've seen no significant movement whatsoever. In fact, it seems like the only major announcement in the last 6 months was the recent announcements that the SEC and Department of Justice were closing down different investigations into Goldman Sachs. So we haven't seen much. And while I suspect that there's still, between now and the election, we'll probably see some sort of civil cases that emerge.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's been very, very little movement in actual criminal prosecutions, and I think it's becoming increasingly less likely that those will occur. We have a ticking statute of limitations for most of these crimes. It's 5 years after the crime was committed, which we're really running out of time for, and we just haven't seen that. And you know, one of the things I talk about in the book, I was interfacing with Department of Justice frequently because we investigated cases. We're like a mini FBI for TARP, and brought some good cases. You know, we have a multi-billion-dollar accounting fraud where some executives tried to steal more than $500 million from TARP, which we were able to shut down before the money went out the door. But I found a real timidity with Department of Justice and a real reluctance to bring complex cases, as well as a lack of sophistication and really understanding how to do these cases. So,
mm-hmm.
I think all of that sort of leads me to be very skeptical that we're going to see any big cases arising out of the crisis at this point.
We haven't even mentioned his name yet, but let's talk about Timothy Geithner. You say that he would shoulder a large portion for the blame if Obama were to lose in November. You had some run-ins with him. Give us a better understanding of who this man is, who he works for, what his philosophy is, and what would make you say that he would share a large portion of the blame should Obama lose in November?
Well, first, I just want to stress, I don't really know Tim Geithner personally all that well. I had a very small handful of meetings with him during the more than 2 years that we overlapped in Washington. He really kept me at arm's length and usually kept some other Treasury bureaucrat between me and him. My handful of interactions with him, though, were uniformly unpleasant, I would say. Probably the most notable one in the book was towards the end of 2009, after I had spent almost a full year trying to get Treasury to require the banks to report on how they were using TARP funds, and ultimately I convinced him to have a private meeting where we could discuss that issue. And his reaction was quite extreme. After I made my pitch and was arguing to him that the failure to be more transparent was really contributing to an understandable sense in the country that this bailout was bought and paid for by the basically for the benefit of the banks, that by not being more transparent about what was going on, it was fueling people's suspicion that there was something to hide, and that overall failures of transparency were going to help create more and more anger and be a real negative reflection, not on just on him and the Treasury Department, but also the president. And he reacted violently, and it was an expletive laced tirade against me, where he was using rather extreme, coarse language to express his disagreement with me, shall we say?
Mm-hmm.
So and what I saw in that conversation, though, beneath the profanity, was a real reluctance to engage in the conversation. He wasn't interested in hearing my arguments about what the economists had said and what the accountants had said. It was really sticking to this line that he had heard from Wall Street that it just wouldn't be possible, that the banks, the money was fungible. And it was just echoing what I had heard from financial institutions for so long. And I think that sort of captured the essence of our dealings with Tim Geithner. The other sort of major interaction I had with him was when we were pressing him on the failed housing program. Even though, in order to get the second half of TARP funds released, Treasury had a promise to Congress that they would launch a $50 billion foreclosure mitigation mortgage modification program. And that was announced in February of 2009, but towards the end of 2009, it was becoming pretty apparent that this program was going nowhere and was not going to come anywhere close to achieving its goals. And we were at a broader oversight meeting. Elizabeth Warren was there, who had headed the Congressional Oversight Panel, a different oversight body for TARP. And she was really grilling Geithner on how this program was going to help the up to 4 million people that it was promised to do. And Geithner's response, I think, was very telling. He defended the program by saying that, you know, notwithstanding our concerns that it wasn't reaching homeowners, that it was really helping to, in his words, was, quote, foam the runway for the banks. And he explained that in his view, the banks could handle certain number of millions of additional foreclosures over a certain period of time, but any more than that, it could trigger the need for more TARP money. They could be back into failure territory again, and that this program would help extend out the foreclosure crisis for the banks, which is a very sort of telling thing, in that this one program that was supposed to help homeowners in Main Street out of TARP ended up really being more about helping the banks pad their profits and extend this thing out. And some of the failures of the program suddenly made sense. And I'm sure there are plenty of people listening out there who've been victimized by this program, by the banks who use the program to extend people out in these endless trial modifications before pulling the rug out from under them and throwing them on the foreclosure scrap heap of the abuses that the banks did to homeowners, for which Treasury would never hold them accountable, even when we were begging them to start using some sort of penalties against the banks. And I think that helped explain sort of where Geithner was coming from and why these failures. You know, from a Treasury perspective, the program was successful in that it achieved its primary goal of extending out the foreclosure crisis so the banks could rebuild their balance sheets and return themselves to the record profits that Wall Street and bonuses that Wall Street earned in 2010, even while leaving the Main Street and homeowners behind. And as I guess the last part of your question of why do I hold Geithner accountable, it's because these were the types of policy choices that were made. They were made not to help use the TARP funds as intended to help struggling homeowners, not to use the TARP funds to help small businesses, but just to protect and eventually grow the too-big-to-fail banks so that they're now even bigger than they were before the crisis. And this anemic economic recovery and continuing ongoing problem in housing, you know, is part of why our economy is stuck in neutral, and that blame, to me, goes back to these failed policies.
And the reason you would protect the banks is because you need money for reelection, or because you believe in the philosophy that he followed? It's just a different kind of political philosophy.
You know, I'm always reticent to crawl too deeply into the minds of people, so I could just base it on what he said and what the people around him said. And what I saw was this real deference adoption of a Wall Street ideology. Mm. The sense of, you know, to put it in colloquial terms, what's good for Wall Street is good for Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
And that protecting the banks became an end of in and of itself, with the belief that with healthier banks, or even protected banks is probably better way to phrase it, that would trickle down to the broader economy. You know, but I also think that accompanying that was a noticeable contempt for people outside of the bubble of Wall Street. You know, certainly was expressed towards me and towards Elizabeth Warren, but I also saw it towards the people who were paying for this, the taxpayer. I mean, I was told time and time again that I shouldn't be as transparent with some of the information I was providing because ordinary people just wouldn't understand it. And they just get confused by the charts and the numbers, and that our explanations wouldn't help with that confusion. And so I think that there's part of that too. I think if you don't know people who've gone through foreclosure or who've suffered from this financial crisis, you know, it's hard to relate to what the impact mm-hmm. of these policies are on real people. And most, not Geithner himself, of course, but almost every single other person that I was dealing with and who was advising or participating in the TARP program came from one of these large Wall Street banks, Merrill Lynch, Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns. And so I think that when you surround yourself with people who have a uniform ideology, and you start screaming into that echo chamber, what comes bouncing back is that same ideology. And I think that's what Geithner and his team had eventually adopted.
Mm. Walk around in other people's shoes, you might have a different view. Huh? Neil Barofsky is our guest. He is author of Bailout, an inside account of how Main Street abandoned Washington abandoned Main Street while rescuing Wall Street. Neil is the former Inspector General in charge of oversight for TARP. He is a senior fellow at the New York University School of Law. To your phone calls, more of them in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, John in Watertown. Hi.
Yeah, we have to refer back to what the Honorable Robert Schindler said. He's the emeritus professor from Yale in New Haven. He said, first of all, you must look into the vicissitudes and the vagaries of capitalism, and nobody, including WPR, wants to talk about the rotten tricks and the tenets of capitalism which cause all this greed and all this avarice.
Do we need that kind of conversation, Neil?
Well, look, I think that it's important to understand how Washington works as well, and as sort of an extension of that. And, you know, one of the things to talk about in the book is the type of dirty tricks and manipulation of the media and the dissemination of half-truths that come out of our government, as well as from some of the aspects of capitalism. You know, but ultimately, you know, I think one of the things to remember is that with the bailouts and the ongoing support of the too-big-to-fail banks, this isn't really what capitalism is about. Capitalism is about failure and the creative destruction that comes when institutions fail. And what we've done as a government is we've interrupted the normal flows of capitalism by preserving a bunch of financial institutions that took extraordinary risks, did so in part based on the presumption that they would eventually be bailed out. And by rescuing them, we create this moral hazard, as it's called, which is basically what that means is an incentive for them to once again pile on more and more risk and under the quest for immediate short-term profits that they and their executives get to keep when the risks turn out well, with the losses being borne by the taxpayer and American society when the risks go bad. And the fact that after this crisis, rather than disrupting that system and breaking up the banks that caused this because of this presumption of bailout, we've reaffirmed it and now have banks that are bigger and more dangerous than ever. So, you know, I think that's part of the concern as well.
Jean in Wauwatosa, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for a great show again, Kathleen.
Thank you.
And a really good book, must-read book, I guess. Last weekend I was watching Frost Nixon again, and there was a concern about cynicism and the loss of young people getting into politics. Well, we got people involved, but, I mean, this is an election year. We need to have the best turnout we can. But a couple of points with given that, how do you personally, but also how do the rest of us just not become massively cynical?
And well, I think that a little bit of cynicism is probably necessary, especially when evaluating what you're hearing, you know, whether it's on the news or coming from the government. But ultimately, you know, one of the reasons why I wrote this book was that, you know, we have to have hope, and it is going to be a long struggle, and there's no short path to sort of breaking up this incredible vice-like grip that the interests of the big financial institutions and Wall Street has on our government. But it's a battle that we need to start fighting, and it is hard. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that we have to do is to stop reelecting or stop voting for officials who aren't willing to take on this issue, who aren't willing to challenge the notion that we have these giant banks and support those who want to bring back Glass-Steagall, the Depression era bill that broke the riskier parts of the banks off from the safer, more important core banking commercial banking business, and I think that's part of it, and supporting young young candidates and getting people involved in the system, and they're not always going to win. I was supporting Lisa Epstein, who is a remarkable fighter for foreclosure against foreclosure fraud down in Palm Beach County, and she lost her primary yesterday for clerk of the county court, and you know she just would have been terrific, but you know what, she ran, she got support, she brought national attention, and this you know it's the old cliche, this is a marathon and not a sprint. And, you know, I think we need to encourage candidates like that across the country. And there are people running for Senate and people running for the House right now, you know, who are advocating breaking up the banks and doing what's necessary. So I think that the best thing to do is to try to focus our energy in those elections. And maybe if we get enough of those people elected, that'll send a message to the rest of the incumbents that they need to change their policies, or hopefully they'll be next on the chopping block.
Thanks, Gene, for the call. Mike is next in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Mr. Brodsky. Who owns the Federal Reserve?
I guess you're not asking that question as a literal question, but literally, I guess it's shareholders, which are the commercial banks within each of the district banks, is who owns the Federal Reserve banks. I mean,
that's
technically
right.
They're...
And does the Constitution reserve the power to coin money to the Congress?
Well, this is probably not the best time for a constitutional debate, and I should say, you know, the book does certainly discuss the Federal Reserve, and you know, I think it's accurate that it has become as captured to these interests as the Treasury Department and other apparatuses of government, and you know, that's one of the things that we talk about in the book is that you know, even folks like the president of the New York Fed, Bill Dudley, when we're rolling out some of these programs. You know, would advocate instead of having real protection for the taxpayer or having a real compliance program, that we could trust some of the very institutions that had helped contributed to the financial crisis, like the credit rating agencies, which had failed so miserably. Something that he said that he was comfortable relying on because he didn't think they would quote unquote embarrass themselves again. So whether their technical ownership is through the shares of the banks. Or their ideological ownership from the interests of Wall Street is very much a core part of the problem.
One of the critiques of your book, Neil, says, well, you know, there maybe were some problems here. There should have been more rigorous investigation of where the money went. But after all, the banks were stabilized and the car companies have come back.
Right, and look, you know, that, I think that is, and I mentioned that in the book, and I've actually been one of the first people to note that these were some important successes for the TARP program of staving off a financial collapse. But it is the worst type of revisionist history to suggest that this program was intended only to preserve what was a fundamentally broken status quo and to protect from failure a group of banks that had taken such risks and had driven our country into this horrible recession and anemic recovery. And that's why Treasury promised and ultimately Congress required Treasury to do much more than just shovel hundreds of billions of dollars into the banks to, when you think about it, to accomplish what is not the totally remarkable goal of then preventing them from collapsing. That's why we were supposed to have increased lending. We're supposed to have a noticeable impact on the economy. We're supposed to have a foreclosure modification and foreclosure relief. You know, Joseph Stiglitz once testified that essentially TARP wasn't done to save the banks. TARP was done to save the economy, mm-hmm. and that's how it should be. That's how it should be properly assessed. And its failure to do so is necessary, in my view, from a basic concept of good government, has to be evaluated when considering the impact and the effect of this program. And since it's failed that goal, to me, in many ways, TARP remains to be a failure, even though things would have been much worse, conceivably, without it.
Randy, hi.
Yeah, hi. What you're saying is exactly right, but the real failure is that big concerns like AIG got their debts and errors forgiven, and the middle class got their debts and errors foreclosed. And what that did is it transferred the wealth. It magnified by light speed the transfer of wealth. And when a politician, and I do think that's going to be a problem for this administration, because when they say they're in favor of the middle class and they couldn't figure out, here's this cash, AIG and companies like you, and you took out big ads on the back of things like Time Magazine and promised we're the organization for your great-great-grandchildren, and we're going to insure the world. Now, here, we need a billions of dollars to bail out the mistakes we made. Oh, don't ask for debt forgiveness for your mistakes. Ask to be refinanced and beg to be refinanced, and you might not get it. We're going to give them the money they're going to hold on to. And AIG and companies like that are still out there fat and happy.
Neil.
No, and I think the important thing to remember is that these were not accidents. These were a series of policy choices. You know, a decision was made to pay AIG's bank counterparties, as you said, 100 cents on the dollar, even though at the time, the government was buying bonds that were worth less than half of that amount. The government made the choice to spend $168 million of taxpayer money to give to bonuses to AIG executives, because they told me internally, as I discuss in the book, that they thought these people were necessary to unwind these complex transactions, even though thousands of dollars went to people who were kitchen assistants and mailroom clerks. And these were all a series of decisions. And when you see that the poverty rate and the projections are that it's going to be the highest it was in 50 years, you know, where do you think those people are coming from? These are people who are falling out of the middle class and into poverty because and a result of some of these policies. So I think the anger expressed by the gentleman in this call is dead on accurate. And people should be angry at what happened here. I mean, they should be angry that their government, which is supposed to serve their interests and supposed to protect their funds, put the interests of these Wall Street institutions above theirs. And look, the reason why I'm angry is, well, that's why I wrote this book, because there's so much anger, whether it's on the left for people who support Occupy or on the right for people who support Tea Party, who intuitively know that the game has been rigged, who intuitively know that our system has been unfair. And what I hope to do with this book is to give them the evidence to back up those suggestions from someone who is in on the inside, who saw what I saw, and to bring the reader alongside with me so they can gather this evidence the way that I did back over the course of these years.
Thanks, Randy. Bart in Boulder Junction. Hi.
Yeah, Mr. Borofsky. I've heard you a couple times on other shows, and you were great, as you have been on this one.
Thank you.
Truly appreciate honesty as opposed to the fair and balanced crap we seem to be constantly exposed to. But something happened to me recently I'd like you to comment on. In the last 3 years, I've refinanced my mortgage twice. And each time, the loan was bought by Fannie and Freddie. I thought we were in the process of dismantling that organization, but yet they seem to be doing the same things they've done in the past. Can you comment?
One of the typical pieces of empty rhetoric we've heard in Washington during the whole, you know, supposed financial reform debate was that trust us, we're going to get to Fannie and Freddie eventually. You know, and of course, their collapse has cost the taxpayer, well, I think, around $150 billion and counting. And there's been no plan. You know, Treasury, about a year or so ago, put out, you know, three different options that could possibly be pursued. But no one has actually done anything to push this. And you know, I think it is one of the unfortunate failures of how we're going to contend with these institutions, which, you know, have caused such losses and really have become a proxy for housing policy in this country. And it is a real problem. And the problems with Fannie and Freddie have been legion. They've been in the news recently. They're refusing to do the types of principal reductions that might be real relief to a bunch of homeowners. Very much similar to, you know, Tim Geithner and the Treasury Department and the Obama administration's refusal to have meaningful principal reduction programs, something I fought for unsuccessfully while I was down in Washington. But it continues to be an issue, and I think that, you know, neither side really, they all like to talk about it, but we haven't seen any meaningful movement. And frankly, I'm really skeptical that we will. I mean, perhaps after the next election, there might be a time. But as they've stabilized, which is not terribly surprising given the fact that they have essentially free cost of funds because of their government guarantee, there will be less of a push for the necessary and needed reforms of them, I'm afraid to say.
Thank you very much for the call. In less than a minute, what perhaps is the most significant change that we could make to ensure that the interests of the taxpayers are upheld in Washington?
We got to break up the banks. It's just that simple. We need to, and you know, there's different ways of doing it. We can bring back a form of Glass-Steagall, which separates them out. There was very strong support for a bill that was sponsored by Senators Brown and Kaufman in 2010 called the SAFE Act, which would have put limits on the size of banks. And this was a bill that had bipartisan support. Republicans supported it, Democrats supported it, and ultimately it was killed by the administration, who were fighting back on that type of reform. We need higher capital levels for the banks. But ultimately we have this giant corrupting influence. We need to break up that influence. I think it's a vital first step, and by doing so, we're going to make our financial system a lot safer, and it'll be a lot more beneficial to everyone else in the economy, not just the executives and those public officials who serve their interests.
Thank you, Neil, so much. Thanks for the time and the book.
Thank you for having me.
Neil Barofsky, his book is Bailout, an inside account of how Washington abandoned Main Street while rescuing Wall Street. He is currently a senior fellow at the New York University School of Law, and he served from 2008 to 2011 as Special Inspector General in charge of oversight of the TARP program. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produced this program. Tomorrow during our 10 o'clock, a celebration of Irish Fest, which opens tomorrow, actually, on the lakefront in Milwaukee. And we'll also look at a history of guns in the United States the first hour. Thanks for listening. Great conversations ahead.